such a long and tall. Now she sleeps in the kitchen with her feet in a hole. Yes, hotter, mother than the red hot. Yes, now she got her for sale. I mean, yes, she got her for sale, yeah.
Felt a little hesitation in my step today. Maybe I'm falling behind. I stirred in my conscience that shook my faith. Put a shadow of doubt in my mind. My regrets are few. I've traveled this far with you. If it's my time, yeah, I don't mind. Blood of my blood, long as I breathe, I'll fight for you. Long as you need blood of my blood, I'll always be strong. I'm on your side forever, whatever side you're on. I was back in the saddle again. You and me out on the road. Ice in our veins, silver in our pockets. Little mercy in our soul. Maybe I've been unkind, sure I've been cruel. But to these simple things, I'm always true. Blood of my blood, long as I breathe, I fight for you. Long as you need blood of my blood, we'll always be strong. I'm on your side forever, whatever side you're on. Seemed like yesterday that we were young and fair, cool wind at our backs and hair, followed everywhere, hair, followed everywhere. Now heaven in a silence has spoken. I know the angels have gone. Wasted and broken, trembling in another cold gray dawn. I'm grateful for the ground that I'm returning to now. I'm grateful for the clouds raining down. Blood in my blood, long as I breathe, I'll fight for you. Long as you need blood of my blood, always be strong. I'm on your side forever, whatever side you're on.
When you use a Waramps key tag, you're giving yourself peace of mind, and you're supporting the CHAMP program for child amputees. If you lose your keys, the Waramps can return them to you by courier with the help of your personalized key tag. Key return by courier. It's simple, fast, and it's free. What's more, thanks to your support, child amputees receive the artificial limbs they need to lead active lives. Order your key tags at 1-800-250-3030 or waramps.ca.
Good morning, you're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. I'm Joshua with It's Pretty Trivial. Hopefully everyone's having a great week and enjoying their day so far. I know it's been rough with all the new cases in Thunder Bay, so I hope everyone's staying safe, happy, and healthy. Today's episode I thought would be a good one to cover a certain day that when this episode comes out will be the day after on the Wednesday. And that is a day that I'm sure everyone knows and loves, especially for drinking. That is St. Patrick's Day, which is on March 17th. St. Patrick's Day, which is a feast day of March 17th of St. Patrick, who is the patron saint of what? He is the patron saint of Ireland. He was born in Roman Britain in the late 4th century, was kidnapped at the age of 16 and taken to Ireland as a slave. He escaped, but returned about 1432 to convert the Irish to Christianity. By the time of his death on March 17th, 461, he had established monasteries, churches, and schools. Many legends grew up around him. For example, that he drove the snakes out of Ireland and used the shamrock to explain the Trinity. Ireland came to celebrate this day with religious services and feasts. And of course, like I said, it's celebrated March 17th, which is Wednesday. However, why did it turn into such a secular holiday? Well, it turns out it was the immigrants, particularly to the U.S., who transformed St. Patrick's Day into the largely secular holiday of revelry and celebration of things Irish. Cities with large numbers of Irish immigrants, who often wielded political power, staged the most extensive celebrations, which included elaborate parades. Boston held its first St. Patrick's Day parade in what year? In 1737, followed by New York City in 1762, and since 1962, Chicago has colored its river green to mark the holiday. Although blue was the color traditionally associated with St. Patrick's Day, green is now more commonly connected with the day. Irish and non-Irish alike commonly participate in the wearing of green, sporting an item of green clothing or a shamrock, the Irish national plant, in the lapel. Corned beef and cabbage are associated with the holiday, and even beer is sometimes dyed green to celebrate the day. Although some of the practices eventually were adopted by the Irish themselves, they did so largely for the benefit of tourists. Now, there isn't too much about St. Patrick's Day, but I think it's good to maybe even talk about, you know, the history of Ireland in this episode and a little bit about maybe Europe and some history, because it is a Irish holiday after all. We're going to start with the early times of Irish history. Now, the early time in Ireland starts off with, well, Gaelic Ireland and medieval Ireland. And then we'll move on from there. Now, politically, Ireland during this time was organized into a number of petty kingdoms, or clans, tuatha, each of which was quite independent under its elected king. Groups of tuatha tended to combine, but the king who claimed overlordship in each group had a primacy of honor rather than of justification. Not until the 10th century AD was there a king of all Ireland, Ard Ri Iorán, a division of the country into five groups of tuatha, known as the Five Fifths, Cuig Cuigi, and it occurred at about the beginning of the Christian era. These were the Ulster, Meath, Leinster, Munster, and Connaught. Surrounding a king was an aristocracy, whose land and property rights were clearly defined by law, and whose main wealth was in cattle. Greater landowners were supported by Cili, or clients. These and other grades of society, minutely classified and described by legal writers, tilled the soil and tended the cattle. Individual families were the real units of society and collectively exercised powers of ownership over their farms and territory. At law, the family, fine, did not merely act corporately, but was, by one of the oldest customs, held responsible for the observance of this law by its kindred, serfs, and slaves. There were no urban centers, and the economic basis of society was cattle rearing and agriculture. The principal crops were wheat, barley, oats, flax, and hay, and it was tilled with plows drawn by oxen. Sheep appeared to have been bred principally for their wool, and other animals reared specifically for slaughter was the pig. Fishing, hunting, fowling, and trapping provided additional food, and the transport of goods over land was by pack horse, for wheeled vehicles appear to have been few. Sea transport was by curra, a wicker frame boat covered with hides. The normal freshwater craft was the dugout. The dwellings of the period were built by the post and wattle technique, and some were situated within the protected sites archaeologists call ring forts. Excavations have shown that some of these may have existed even in the Bronze Age, and that they remained a normal place of habitation until medieval times. Advantage was also taken of the relative security of islands in rivers or lakes as dwelling places, and artificial islands called crannogs were also extensively made. The Irish law points to a large development of rural industry in the period in which they were first written down, shortly before the Norse invasions, beginning at the end of the 8th century. They deal minutely not only with the management of land and animal rearing, but also the innumerable further details of husbandry, including milling, dyeing, dairying, malting, meat curing, and spinning and weaving. Wool was spun with a wooden spindle, weighed with a war of bone or stone, and it was woven on a loom. The outer garment worn by both men and women was a large woolen cloak, brat, fastened on the shoulder or breast with a pin or brooch. The inner garment was a long linen tunic, girded at the waist with a belt. Shoes of raw hide or tanned leather were worn, at least by the upper classes and the higher professional ranks. A large amount of metalwork reveals the adaptation by Irish craftsmen of many techniques originating in Britain or on the European continent. An instinct for design, added to the skillful use of these techniques, enabled them to produce many superb objects, of which the Tara brooch, dating from about the mid-8th century, is an outstanding example. And the chief musical instrument of the period was the harp. Now, this goes back quite far. And the reason I kind of want to mention this is because this also comes around an important time about St. Patrick's Day. Early Christianity in Ireland. And again, I'm getting my data today from Britannica.com. Little is known of the first impact of Christianity on Ireland. Traditions in the south and southeast refer to early saints who allegedly preceded St. Patrick, and their missions may well have come through trading relations with the Roman Empire. The earliest firm date is what? Earliest firm date is AD 431, when St. Germanus, Bishop of Auxerre in Gaul, which is modern-day France, proposed, with the approval of Pope Celestine I, to send a certain Palladius to the Scots believing in Christ. Subsequent missionary history in Ireland is dominated by the figure of St. Patrick, whose 17th century biographers, Tirshan and Muirshu, credit him with converting all the Irish to Christianity and won for him the status of national apostle. A 9th century record, the Book of Arma, includes a work by Patrick himself, the Confessio, Confession, which is a reply to charges made by British ecclesiastics, in which he describes his life at a Roman villa in Britain, his capture by Irish raiders, and his 7 years of slavery in Ireland. Recovering his freedom, he claimed he was educated and ordained in the priesthood and eventually managed to be sent as a missionary to Ireland. He concentrated on the north and west of the country, achieving remarkable success. He did not himself claim to have converted all of Ireland, and confusion exists regarding the chronology of Patrick's life, and it is seriously contended that tradition came to merge the experience of two men, the continental Platius and the Patrick of the Confessio. No sufficient evidence supports the traditional date, which is what? For the beginning of Patrick's missions, which the traditional date is 432. Of the rival dates, 461, 62, and 492, 93, given for his death in annals and biographies, the latter is now preferred. Although monks and monasteries were to be founded in Ireland at the time of Patrick, their place was then altogether secondary. But in the course of the 6th and 7th centuries, a comprehensive monastic system developed in Ireland, partly through the influence of Celtic monasteries in Britain, such as Candida Casa at Whithorn in Galloway and Llangarvan in Wales. Early attempts to organize the Irish Church on the usual Roman system, in which each bishop and his clergy exercise exclusive jurisdiction within a diocesan, seem to have given way to one in which groups of Christian settlements were loosely linked together, usually under the auspices of someone or other of the great saints. And careful study of the lives in the early saints reveals the manner in which their reputations developed in proportion to the power of the political dynasties that became connected with them. By the end of the 6th century, enthusiasm for Christianity was leading Irishmen to devote themselves to a most austere existence as monks, as hermits, and as missionaries to pagan tribes in Scotland and the north of England, and in a great area of West Central Europe, particularly between the Rhine, Loire, and Rhone rivers. St. Columba's foundation of the Monastery of Iona off the northwest Scottish coast provided the best known base for the Celtic Christianization of Scotland, and its offshoot, Lindisfarne, Holy Island, lying off the coast of the Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Northumbria, which was responsible for the conversion of that area. Of the continental missionaries, the best known is St. Columban, whose monastic foundations at Luxeuil near Angrai in the Vosges and at Bobbio in northern Italy became important centers of learning. Columban, however, by his individualism and austere pietism, came into conflict not only with the Merovingian rulers of Gaul, but also with local ecclesiastical administrations, and his limitations exemplify those of the Irish monastic system as a whole and explain why, in the end, it was supplanted by the ordinary administration system of the church. Very much it is become well, a Christian society. Ireland itself is a very old country. I mean, I did not realize it went back that far. Ireland is very old. I mean, so is England, but I didn't realize it dated back this far. To put it into perspective, the first rulers of England, like William the Conqueror, didn't come in until 1066. We're talking about 200-300 years before then. So quite a while ago. Now, let's talk about the first centuries of the English rule, which started with the Anglo-Norman invasion. Before the arrival of Henry II in Ireland in October of 1171, Anglo-Norman adventurers, including Richard de Clare, Earl of Pembroke, subsequently known as Strongbow, invited by Dermot MacMorrow, a king of Leinster who had been expelled by the High King Roderick O'Connor, had conquered a substantial part of Eastern Ireland, including the Kingdom of Leinster, the towns of Waterford, Wexford, and Dublin, and in part of the Kingdom of Meath. Partly to avert any chance of Ireland's becoming a rival Norman state, Henry took action to impose his rule there. He granted Leinster to de Clare and Meath to Hugh de Lacy, who had gone to Ireland in the king's army. But he kept the chief towns in his own hand, exacted forms of submission from the Irish kings, and secured from a church synod recognition of his overlordship. During subsequent years of the Anglo-Norman sphere in Ireland was extended, and while all the Irish kings, except in the northwest, agreed to recognize his supremacy, Henry was obliged to acquiesce in the establishment of new Norman lordships in Ulster under John de Courcy, and in Munster under de Cogan, de Braos, and others. And by the Treaty of Windsor in 1175, O'Connor, the High King, accepted Henry as his overlord and restyled himself as only the King of Connaught. But he was permitted to exercise some vague authority over the other Irish kings, and was charged with collecting from them tribute to be paid to Henry. The arrangement was unsuccessful, and thereafter O'Connor encountered opposition, even in his own province, and he was ultimately obliged to abdicate. King John, who visited Ireland in 1210, established there a civil government independent of the feudal lords, and during the 13th century it became more fully organized. An Irish exchequer had been set up in 1200, and the chancery followed in 1232. The country was divided into counties for administrative purposes. English law was introduced, and serious attempts were made to reduce the feudal liberties of the Anglo-Norman baronage. Countries were civil administration districts, whereas liberties were lands held in the personal control of aristocratic families and the church. The development of the Irish Parliament paralleled that of its English counterpart. In 1297, the peers and prelates were joined by representatives of counties, and in 1300, the towns also sent members. But these represented the Anglo-Irish only, as the native Irish, to some extent resurgent in Ulster under the O'Neills and O'Donnells, and in the southwest, Munster under the McCarthys, were unrepresented. During the next centuries, which were the 14th and 15th, a brief threat to English control of Ireland was made by Edward Bruce, brother of King Robert I of Scotland, and ended when Bruce was killed in the battle at Foghart near Dundalk in 1318. English control was reasserted and strengthened by the creation of three new Anglo-Irish earldoms: Kildare, to give the head of the Leinster Fitzgeralds, Desmond, given to the head of the Munster Fitzgeralds, and Ormond, given to the head of the Butlers, who held lands around Tipperary. The increased power and lands of the Anglo-Irish brought around an inevitable reaction, and during the remainder of the 14th century, there was a remarkable revival of Irish political power, which was matched by a flowering of Irish language, law, and civilization. The Gaels recovered in large parts of Ulster, Midlands, Connaught, and Leinster, while the Anglo-Irish became increasingly Irish, marrying Irish women and often adopting Gaelic customs. The English government, which was always to some extent opposed by the Anglo-Norman aristocracy because of its aim to curtail feudal privileges, made an effort to restore control, but achieved little more than a definition of the status quo. Edward III's son, Lionel, Duke of Clarence, and Viceroy from 1361 to 67, passed in the Irish Parliament the Statute of Kilkenny, which was in 1366, which listed the obedient English-controlled lands of as Louth, Meath, Trim, Dublin, Carlow, Kildare, Kilkenny, Wexford, and Waterford, and Tipperary. Intermarriage or alliances with the Irish were forbidden. The independent Irish outside the Pale, the area of English control, were regarded as enemies and were assumed to possess their lands only by usurpation. In practice, they were feared, and their attacks were often bought off by regular payments. Visits by King Richard II in 1394-95 and 1399 achieved nothing. During the first half of the 15th century, Ireland was, in effect, ruled by three great earls of Desmond, Ormond, and Kildare, who combined to dominate the Dublin government. Desmond had sway in the counties of Limerick, Cork, Kenny, and Waterford, Ormond in Tipperary and Kilkenny, and Kildare in Leinster. Although both Gaels and Anglo-Irish had supported the Yorkist side in the War of the Roses, the Yorkist King Edward IV found them no less easy to subjugate and had his Lancastrian predecessors. Succeeding in 1468 in bringing about the attainder and execution for treason of Thomas, Earl of Desmond, Edward nevertheless obliged to yield to aristocratic power in Ireland. The Earls of Kildare, who thereafter bore the title of Lord's Deputy, for the English princes were Lord Lieutenants, were in effect the actual rulers of Ireland until well into the 16th century. The substitution in 1485 of Tudor for Yorkist rule in England had no apparent effect on Ireland, where the ascendancy of the Fitzgerald Earls of Kildare established when Thomas, 7th Earl, was created Lord Deputy in 1471, had passed 1477 to his son Garrett More, Great Gerald. The formality of royal power was preserved by appointing an absentee lieutenant for whom Kildare acted as deputy. In practice, Kildare exercised real power through dynastic alliances with the great chief Gaelic and Anglo-Irish lords. Opposition to Kildare was negligible, even when he gave support, 1487, to Lambert Simnel, a pretender to the English throne. After the advent of a more dangerous pretender, Perkin Warbeck, in 1494, it was decided to move Kildare and rule through an Englishman, Sir Edward Poynings. Poynings subdued Kildare, but he could not reconquer the northern Gaelic Irish. At Drogheda, he introduced Parliament to pass an act that came to be known as Ponan's Law, which subjected the meetings and legislative drafts of the Irish Parliament to the control of English kings and council. But Ponan's administrative expenses were too great, and Henry VII decided in 1496 to restore Kildare. On Kildare's death in 1513, the deputyship passed to his son Garrett Og, young Gerald, 9th Earl of Kildare, who continued, though less impressively, to dominate the country. But James, 10th Earl of Desmond, intrigued with the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V and Henry VIII, became convinced that Kildare had lost the power to control Ireland in the interests of the English crown. Therefore, when Henry's divorce of Catherine of Aragon in 1533 made the danger of imperial intervention particularly acute, the king dismissed Kildare. Thereafter, there were no Irish-born viceroys for more than a century. This is when it becomes time for the Reformation period. Rumors that Kildare had been executed precipitated the rebellion of his son, Thomas Fitzgerald, Lord Offaly, called Silken Thomas. The rebellion facilitated the transition to a new system. Silken Thomas had opposed Henry VIII's breach with Rome. His rebellion failed and was executed in 1537, which caused a revival of the power of the Butlers of Ormond. Piers Butler, Earl of Ossory, helped to secure the enactment of royal, instead of papal, ecclesiastical supremacy by the Dublin Parliament of 1536 and 37. As a further step in shedding papal authority, in 1541, a complacent parliament recognized Henry VIII as King of Ireland. His predecessors had held the title of Lord of Ireland. Confiscations of monastic property, as well as the lands of the rebels, met most of the costs of the expanded administration. This loss of land inevitably drove the religious orders and the Anglo-Irish into the arms of the Gaelic Irish, thus weakening the old ethnic rivalries of medieval Ireland. That about does it for the first half of the show. When we come back, we will talk about a little bit more of the history of Ireland. And if we have time, talk about pie a little bit. So please stay tuned here on CILU 102.7 FM.
CILU is sponsored in part by the students of Lakehead University, our listeners, and our sponsors. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
Lakehead Unitarian Fellowship, an inclusive spiritual community promoting a compassionate, just, and sustainable world. Find them online at luf.ca, on Facebook, or at 129 South Algoma, Sundays at 10:30 a.m. The Live from the Rock Folk Festival, bringing the spirit of folk and folk music to Red Rock every August. Keep up to date with upcoming happenings and buy tickets online at livefromtherockfolkfestival.com. The Outpost, Lakehead University's pub, full-service restaurant, and live music venue. Find them on Facebook to stay up to date on all the happenings during the school year, like Tanker Tuesdays and Pub Night Thursdays.
Welcome back. You're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. Thank you for tuning in today. If you're just joining us now, welcome. If you joined us in the first half, welcome back. Hope you're enjoying today's episode. Before, we were talking about the early history of Ireland, especially because St. Patrick's Day is, as of the recording of the, not, sorry, as of when this recording comes out, tomorrow. But we only got about halfway there. So, without further ado, let's get back into it. Before the break, we were talking about kind of the end of the Kildares, kind of the rise of King Henry VIII. I was about to mention how Sir Anthony St. Ledger, Lord Deputy in 1540 to 48 and again 50 to 56, became a conciliatory policy by which outstanding lords were persuaded to renounce the Pope and recognize the king's ecclesiastical supremacy in order to gain new titles and grants of land. The policy, however, required a steady series of efficient governors and disciplined administrators. In fact, neither in Tudor nor in Stuart times did the English succeed in converting elective chiefs into hereditary nobles holding offices delegated by the crown. Moreover, even those who had recently submitted were often condemned for religious conservatism and deprived of their land. St. Leger's personal success was all the more remarkable because the first Jesuit mission to Ireland arrived in the north in 1542. Under Edward VI, which was 1547 to 53, the Dublin authorities carried out a forward policy in religion as well as politics, but Protestantism got no support except from English officials. The official restoration of Roman Catholicism under Queen Mary in 53 to 58 revealed the strength of resentment in Ireland against Protestantism. As in England, the papal jurisdictions were restored, but otherwise the Tudor regulations of authority were observed. The Pope was induced to recognize the conversion of the Tudor Irish lordship into a kingdom. Finally, Mary gave statutory approval for the plantation or resettlement of Irish lands by Englishmen of Leek, Offaly, and other Irish lordships of the Central Plain. Her viceroy was Thomas Radcliffe, Earl of Sussex, Lord Deputy, from 56 to 59, who was soon, as Lord Lieutenant for Elizabeth I, to restore the state's authority over the church. Under Elizabeth I, the Acts of Supremacy and Uniformity, which enforced the Anglican Church settlement, were passed in Ireland in 1560, but fear of driving the inhabitants of the Pale into alliance with the Gaelic Irish, and perhaps with the Spanish, made the government lenient in enforcing the terms of the Act. Political affairs continued to preoccupy the administrators, so the new Protestant Church was unequipped to resist the forces of the Counter-Reformation. It was inevitable in an Ireland only superficially conformed to royal obedience. But the seriousness of the situation was shown by the three great rebellions of the reign, those of Shane O'Neill, 1559, of the Fitzgeralds of Desmond, from 68 to 83, and of the O'Neill, Tyrone, and O'Donnell, 94 to 03. The first of the rebellions, which was the Shane O'Neill, fully exposed the weakness and later the folly of the government. O'Neill's father, Con Bacatch, who as the O'Neill was head of a whole network of clans, had been made Earl of Tyrone in 1541, and the succession rights of his illegitimate son, Theodoract Matthew, were recognized. Shane, younger but the eldest legitimate son, was elected O'Neill on his father's death in 1559, and afterwards Theodoragd was killed. O'Neill then battled against the Dublin government, demanding recognition according to the laws of primogeniture, and he insisted that neither of Theodoragd's sons, Brian and Hugh, had claims to the earldom. Elizabeth invited O'Neill to London to negotiate, but the opportunity for a statesman settlement was lost. O'Neill was to be captain of Tyrone and was encouraged to expel from Antrim the MacDonald migrants from Scotland. Returning to Ireland in May of 1562, O'Neill routed the MacDonalds as well as the loyal O'Donnells of the Northwest, and attempted to secure support from Scotland and France. Eventually, the government was saved from a serious situation only through the defeat of O'Neill by the O'Donnells and his murder in 1567 by the MacDonalds. The land of the O'Neills and even of loyal Gaelic lords were declared forfeit in 1569. And, in a wave of enthusiasm for colonization, various questionable adventurers were permitted to attempt substantial plantations in Munster, Leinster, and Ulster. The folly of this policy was seen when the government, despite its having declared the position of O'Neill extinguished, allowed the O'Neills to select Shane's cousin, Turlough Luinich, as their chief. The Butlers and Munster Fitzgeralds also combined forcibly to resist the plantations. The only gleam of statesmanship shown in these years by Henry Sidney, Lord Deputy, was that he managed to avoid a major combination against the government's religious policy. The Butlers were induced to submit, the planters were given only limited support, and a head-on collision with Turlough Luinich was averted. When the Ulster Plantations Plan could not be carried out against Irish resistance, the Queen wisely decided that they should be dropped. The pardon of the Butlers pacified Leinster, and, although in Munster the Earl of Desmond's cousin, James Fitzgerald, called Fitzmaurice, attempted to make the war one of religion, he too was eventually pardoned. Despite the pardon, Fitzmaurice fled to the European continent in 1575, returning to Ireland in 1579 with papal approval for the Roman Catholic Crusade against Queen Elizabeth. Although neither France nor Spain supported the crusade, and Fitzmaurice was surprised and killed in August of 1579, the government was extremely apprehensive. Gerald Fitzgerald, 14th Earl of Desmond, then assumed direction of the enterprise. As a military commander, he was wholly deficient, and his mediocrity may well have kept outstanding figures in the north and west out of the movement. The rebels were defeated, and in November 1580, a force of Italians and Spaniards was massacred at Dunanore, Golden Fort, Sumerick Harbor, Count Kerry. The end of the Desmond Rebellion gave the government the opportunity to confiscate more than 300,000 acres or 100,000 hectares in Munster and initiate more stringent proceedings against Roman Catholics. But the plantation was not a success. A more statesmanlike attitude was displayed in regard to Connaught land titles. When Sir John Perrott was Lord Deputy, a number of agreements were made with individual landowners and chieftains, by which titles were officially recognized in order for regular fixed payments. This was a step in the process of converting a great part of the country to English tenures. Perrott was less successful in handling the 1585-86 Parliament, in which the government's anti-Catholic program was defeated by the opposition. The origins of the Third Rebellion, the O'Neill-Tyrone War, remain in doubt. Both Hugh Roe O'Donnell and Hugh O'Neill, youngest son of Fiordoracht, for whom the Earldom of Tyrone had been revived in 1585, and who had been elected O'Neill on Turlough Luinich's death in 1595, certainly resented the extension of the royal administration, but the religious issue was probably more important. For a generation, exiled Roman Catholics had been trained as missionaries in the continental colleges of the Counter-Reformation, and the majority of those who returned to Ireland concluded that Catholicism could survive there only if Elizabeth was defeated. The outbreak of hostilities in Ulster in 1594 was at first confined to the northwest, where O'Donnell and Maguire, Lord of Fermanagh, tried to drive out the English troops. The intervention of Hugh O'Neill was expected, if not inevitable. His participation with his brother-in-law O'Donnell proved decisive in the north and west, and the English were defeated in both Ulster and Connaught. A more intimidating combination thus threatened Dublin than even in Shale O'Neill's time. Even the pale, arbitrary exactions and exclusion from offices won Hugh much sympathy. And it was said that he knew of Dublin Castle decisions before they were known in the city. Resentful of O'Neill's alleged ingratitude, Elizabeth became impatient of negotiations with him and finally sent Robert Devereux, 2nd Earl of Essex, to Ireland in 1599 to subdue him. But Essex lost his reputation by his inglorious progress through the country and by the speed with which he returned to England after a private conversation with O'Neill. Before Charles Blount, Lord Mountjoy, arrived in 1600 to replace Essex, the Irish leaders had gained the qualified support of Pope Clement VIII and of King Philip III of Spain. But Philip could not afford to send only a minimal force to aid the Irish rebels. Its leader, Juan del Aguila, occupied Kinsale and was besieged in 1601 by Mountjoy. O'Neill marched south to relieve Anguilla, but a rash attempt to surprise the English lines by night proved disastrous, and the Irish were defeated by the Spaniards and the Spaniards surrounded. O'Neill held out in Ulster for more than a year, but finally submitted a few days after the Queen's death on March of 1603. Viewed generally, Elizabeth's Irish policy had the distinction of having reduced the country to obedience for the first time since the invasion of Henry II. But her policies had serious costs. The loyalty of the Irish was perennially strained over the religious issue, so that further rebellion was almost inevitable and virtually predictable in 1640 when the English government was embarrassed by the Second Bishop's War with Scotland. Economically, the towns and the countryside were needlessly exploited by the new administration and planters, while the Queen's expenditure was substantially increased. Commitments in Ireland were at least partly responsible for the poverty of the crown, which was to become a serious factor in precipitating its 17th century conflict with Parliament. Now, during the 17th century, around the time of James I, James VI of Scotland, who became King James I of England and Ireland in 1603, presumed a more moderate Irish policy than Elizabeth I, whose commitment to war against the papacy and against Catholic Spain impelled her antagonism towards Irish Catholics. But although James made peace with Spain, his guarded religious tolerance was nullified by the intransigence of the established Anglican Church and of the papacy. James, like Elizabeth, bent Irish policy to meet the interests of the English governing class, and the steady exodus of Irish soldiers and churchmen to Roman Catholic countries in Europe was unabated. In the short term, their absence contributed to peace, but their influence abroad gave the Irish question an international dimension. In Ireland, the overwhelming majority of the Gaelic Irish and of the Old English Anglo-Irish remained detached from government. As soon as James's policy became clear, the Earls of Tyrone and Tyrconnell and the other Ulster Gaelic lords joined the flight from Ireland. Their departure in 1607 opened the way for the plantation of Ulster by a new English and Scottish landowning class. It proved to be the most successful British settlement in Ireland because the planters included British tenants and laborers as well as landlords. The newcomers were mainly from Scotland lowlands, and the English at first so feared them as competitors that the charter granted to London companies in 1613 added the prefix London to the name of the historic ecclesiastical settlement of Derry in an attempt to solidify English holdings. The Presbyterianism of the Scottish immigrants was successfully kept at bay until the time of the English Civil Wars. The Anglican bishoprics in Ireland were well endowed and powerful. It was not until 1643 that the first presbytery was established in Belfast. In the Parliament in 1613-15, which was summoned to ratify the Ulster plantation, a small Protestant majority was achieved because many new boroughs had been created in the newly planted areas. But the government was concerned more with the appearance than the reality of consent, and no parliament was called again until 1633. In the last years of James's reign, pressure from his Spanish and French allies caused him to concede tolerance to the Roman Catholics, and from 1618 a Catholic hierarchy was resident in Ireland. Now, this is a pretty crazy story for me, because we're almost halfway or three quarters of the way through kind of some of the important things in Ireland. But I just want to mention that I think it's really interesting to see such a long storied history in Ireland. I mean, we've all kind of known that Ireland is not part of, you know, Great Britain, but I never realized it had such a storied history. Just a quick reminder, you're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. Now, the next part of the time was during Charles I, when he conceived the idea of raising armies and money in Ireland in return for promises of religious concessions, known as the Graces, which were designed to secure the status of the old English, by permitting Roman Catholics to engage in various public activities. But it was abandoned by Thomas Wentworth, Charles's Lord Deputy of Ireland from 1633 to 40, and later the Earl of Stratford. Wentworth's authoritarian rule was based on a strategy of manipulating the interests of the planters and the natives, as well as those of the Old English and the New English. He sought to break the power of the great magnates and of trade monopolists, both Irish and English, including the London City Companies. He induced the Catholic members of the Irish House of Commons to join in voting large subsidies in the hope of obtaining further concessions. Wentworth's duplicity, most notably his abolition of the remaining graces, his schemes for further plantations, and his personal enrichment by exploitation of the instruments of state, alienated vested interests throughout Ireland. By the time of his impeachment from 1640 to 41, the loyalty to the crown of even the old land-only classes had been so eroded that the king's enemies in Ireland joined with those in England in bringing about his execution in 1641. His Irish army was disbanded, and control of the Irish government passed to the Puritan Lords Justice. A general rising of the Irish in Ulster took place on October 1641, and thousands of colonists were murdered or fled. Ulster Catholics and the Old English joined in a confederation, formalized in 1642 as a Confederation of Kilkenny, but it was racked by dissension. During the English Civil Wars, there were Irish Confederate armies in Ulster and in Leinster. English parliamentary armies operated in the north and south, and Dublin was held by James Butler, Duke of Ormond, commanding an army of Protestant royalists. Negotiations for peace between Ormond and the Confederates were difficult and protracted. And in 1646, when it was clear that Charles's cause was lost, Ormond surrendered Dublin to a parliamentary commander. After the execution of Charles in 1649, the English Parliament appointed Oliver Cromwell as commander-in-chief in Ireland. His nine-month campaign, notorious for the massacre of the garrisons of Drogheda and Wexford, crushed all resistance. By 1652, the conquest of Ireland was complete. During the Commonwealth and Protectorate, Cromwell's appointment as Lord Protector was proclaimed in Dublin in 1654. Authority in Ireland was exercised by parliamentary commissioners and chief governors. A union of the three kingdoms of England, Scotland, and Ireland, effected in 1653, resulted in Irish representatives attending parliaments held in London in 1654, 56, and 59. By an act of settlement, Ireland, regarded as conquered territory, was parceled out among soldiers and creditors of the Commonwealth, and only those Irish landowners able to prove their constant support of the parliamentary cause escaped having their estates confiscated. Of these, those who were Roman Catholics were still obliged to exchange land owned to the northeast or south of the River Shannon for land in Connaught, and Catholics and Anglicans were forbidden to practice their religion. But the campaign against Irish Catholicism was not successful. After the Restoration in 1660, Charles VI personally favored complete religious tolerance, but the forces of militant Protestantism sometimes proved too strong for him. The Commonwealth Parliamentary Union was, after 1660, treated as null and void. Most significant of the events of the Restoration was the Second Act of Settlement, and it enabled Protestants loyal to the Crown to recover their estates. The Act of Explanation obliged the Cromwellian settlers to surrender one-third of their grants and thus provided a reserve of land from which Roman Catholics were partially compensated for losses under the Commonwealth. This satisfied neither group. Catholics were prevented from residing in towns, and local power in both borough and county became appropriated to the Protestant interest. But Protestantism itself became permanently split, as in England, the Presbyterians refused to conform to Episcopalian order and practice, and in association with the Presbyterians of Scotland, organized as a separate church. Under James II, antagonism to the king's Roman Catholicism triggered a reversal of the tendencies of the preceding reign. After his flight from England to France in 1688, James crossed to Ireland, where in Parliament the Acts of Settlements and Explanation were repealed and provisions were made for the restoration of expropriated Catholics. When William III landed in Ireland to oppose James, the country divided denominationally, but the real issue was land, not religion. After his defeat at the Battle of Boyne in 1690, James fled to France, but his Catholic supporters continued in arms until defeated at Aughrim and obliged to surrender in 1691 at Limerick. However, James's supporters secured either the right to go overseas or, if they accepted William's regime, immunity from discriminatory laws. But civil articles to secure tolerance for the Catholics were not ratified, and later Irish leaders were thus enabled to denounce the broken treaty of Limerick. Immediately after Limerick, the Protestant position was secured by Acts of the English Parliament declaring illegal the Acts of King James's Parliament in Ireland and restricting to Protestants membership of future Irish parliaments. The sale of the lands forfeited by James and some of his supporters further reduced the Catholic land ownership in the country. By 1703, it was less than 15%. On this foundation was established the Protestant ascendancy. During the 18th century, the Protestant ascendancy was a supremacy of that proportion of the population, about one-tenth, that belonged to the established Protestant Episcopalian Church. They celebrated their position as a ruling class by annual recollections of their victories over their hated popish enemies, especially at the Battle of Boyne, which was commemorated on July 12th with parades by the Orange Order from the 1790s until today. Not only Catholic majorities, but also Presbyterian and other nonconformists, whose combined numbers exceeded those of the established church, were excluded from full political rights, notably by the Test Act of 1704. Which made tenure of office depending on willingness to receive communion according to the Protestant Episcopalian Church of Ireland rite. Because of their banishment from public life, the history of the Roman Catholic Irish in the 18th century is concerned almost exclusively with the activities of exiled soldiers and priests, many of whom distinguished themselves in the service of continental monarchs. Details of the lives of the unrecorded Roman Catholic majority in rural Ireland can be glimpsed only from ephemeral literature in England, in English, and from Gaelic poetry. That about does it for today. There is a little bit more to talk about, but we're about out of time for today. But I will say, it's an interesting story to read. Especially, you know, a lot of it was a very big fight against, well, the Protestants. The Protestants came in and kind of turned the whole Irish world upside down. Eventually, Ireland gained independence, and to this day are their own independent country. Except for the small bit of Northern Ireland, which is still part of the UK. Now, I didn't manage to get into that today, but maybe in the future I will. And another thing I might cover in a future episode is pi. Yes, the pi in mathematics, as the day of recording this is Pi Day, which is March 14th. Because pi is 3.14, March 14th. So hopefully everyone had a great Pi Day. That about does it for me this episode. I hope you enjoyed. I hope you learned something. And I hope everyone stays safe, especially with everything going on out there. So I'd like to say, have a good week. Stay safe. Stay healthy. This has been Joshua with It's Pretty Trivial. I'm out. See you next week here on CILU 102.7 FM.
As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to spread, it is important to stay safe. Coronavirus is now in Canadian provinces and territories. By law, if you have traveled abroad recently, you must self-isolate. To do your part, stay home as much as possible and practice social distancing. Try to maintain at least 2 meters away from others. Encourage those who are sick or showing symptoms